Part 3. In this part, you will hear two segments from a radio program. After each segment, you will hear six questions about it. Before each segment begins, you will have time to review the questions. You will hear each segment twice. Then you will hear the questions once. Choose the correct answer A, B, or C. Look at the questions, then listen to the first segment. Now you will hear the first segment.
We've all heard about sex discrimination and the underrepresentation of women in science or various professional fields, but few people are aware of the existence of an unconscious gender bias which pervades hiring practices and significantly impacts career advancement prospects for women, Nicholas Wright reports.
Believe it or not, despite significant gains in recent years, female academics encounter biased judgments over their competence and higher ability, while receiving less faculty encouragement and financial rewards than identical male counterparts. At least those were the findings of a survey conducted by Corinne Martinez and other Yale researchers, published last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Corinne Martinez is here to provide the details.
Our experiment, Nicholas, was quite straightforward. We sent 127 science professors around the country, both male and female, the exact same application materials, from a made-up undergraduate student applying for a lab manager position. For 63 of the applications, though, the student was male, named John. For the other 64, the student was female, named Jennifer. Every other element of the application, the resume, grade point average, references, and other materials, was identical.
And from what I understand, the professors were each asked to evaluate the theoretical applicant in several ways: their overall competency and higher ability, the salary they would offer to the student, and the degree of mentoring they felt the student deserved.
That's right, and the results were startling. Both male and female professors consistently regarded the female student applicant as less competent and less hireable than the otherwise identical male student. On a scale of 1 to 5, the average competency rating for the male applicant was 4.05, as compared to 3.33 for the female applicant. The average salary offered to the female was $26,507, while the male was offered $30,238. The professor's age and sex had insignificant effects on this disparity. Old and young, male and female alike, tended to view the female applicants more negatively.
I personally consider these findings especially disappointing because one might expect the participants in the experiment, the 127 science professors, to be among the most enlightened individuals in our society. They have worked with female scientists, and many are in fact female scientists, so it's strange to think that they would actually view them as less competent.
Well, we don't feel that this bias pervades the entire field of science professors, and that's because, in addition to having the professors rate the imagined student, we asked them to fill out the Modern Sexism Scale, a well-established test that can unveil unintentional or subtle negativity towards women rather than an explicit hostility. Those who came into the experiment with a pre-existing unconscious bias against women were much more likely to judge the female applicants as less competent. This means that it's only some of the gatekeepers of science who hold a consistent bias against women. However, the problem does exist, and to address it, we must first accept it, and then implement transparent, objectively fair hiring and evaluation practices in academics.
Now you will hear the segment again.
We've all heard about sex discrimination and the underrepresentation of women in science or various professional fields, but few people are aware of the existence of an unconscious gender bias, which pervades hiring practices and significantly impacts career advancement prospects for women, Nicholas Wright reports.
Believe it or not, despite significant gains in recent years, female academics encounter biased judgments over their competence and hireability, while receiving less faculty encouragement and financial rewards than identical male counterparts. At least those were the findings of a survey conducted by Corinne Martinez and other Yale researchers published last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Corinne Martinez is here to provide the details.
Our experiment, Nicholas, was quite straightforward. We sent 127 science professors around the country, both male and female, the exact same application materials, from a made-up undergraduate student applying for a lab manager position. For 63 of the applications, though, the student was male, named John. For the other 64, the student was female, named Jennifer. Every other element of the application, the resume, grade point average, references, and other materials, was identical.
And from what I understand, the professors were each asked to evaluate the theoretical applicant in several ways: their overall competency and hireability, the salary they would offer to the student, and the degree of mentoring they felt the student deserved.
That's right, and the results were startling. Both male and female professors consistently regarded the female student applicant as less competent and less hireable than the otherwise identical male student. On a scale of 1 to 5, the average competency rating for the male applicant was 4.05, as compared to 3.33 for the female applicant. The average salary offered to the female was $26,507, while the male was offered $30,238. The professor's age and sex had insignificant effects on this disparity. Old and young, male and female alike, tended to view the female applicants more negatively.
I personally consider these findings especially disappointing because one might expect the participants in the experiment, the 127 science professors, to be among the most enlightened individuals in our society. They have worked with female scientists, and many are in fact female scientists, so it's strange to think that they would actually view them as less competent.
Well, we don't feel that this bias pervades the entire field of science professors. And that's because, in addition to having the professors rate the imagined student, we asked them to fill out the Modern Sexism Scale, a well-established test that can unveil unintentional or subtle negativity towards women rather than an explicit hostility. Those who came into the experiment with a pre-existing unconscious bias against women were much more likely to judge the female applicants as less competent. This means that it's only some of the gatekeepers of science who hold a consistent bias against women. However, the problem does exist, and to address it, we must first accept it and then implement transparent, objectively fair hiring and evaluation practices in academics.
Number 39. What is the report mainly about? Number 40. What kind of bias toward applicants did the experiment aim at identifying? Number 41. What did the two groups of applicants in the experiment differ in? Number 42. What was the average competency rating for female applicants? Number 43. Why are the findings of this study disappointing? Number 44. Why do researchers feel that this bias is not typical of professors? Look at the questions, then listen to the second segment. Now you will hear the second segment.
None of us were around when the dinosaurs became extinct, but this doesn't stop us from being fascinated by these awesome animals, and it certainly does not stop scientists from continuing to investigate them. New evidence suggests that carnivorous theropod dinosaurs, who were once thought to be hydrophobic, at least sometimes took a dip in lakes and rivers. Kimberly Morgan reports.
Paleontologists have recently uncovered good evidence that theropod dinosaurs, whose name derives from a Greek phrase meaning beast feet, describing the dinosaurs' oversized appendages, weren't as bothered by water as traditionally believed. In 2013, paleontologists Andrew Mitchell and Martin Perez described swim tracks made by early Jurassic theropods at the site where now stands the city of St. George, Utah. Such traces weren't the first of their kind ever discovered, but the track site was one of the richest ever found. Andrew and Martin are here with us today to give us the fascinating details. Andrew, we're all ears.
Kimberly, we were hired by the American Museum of Natural History and were combing the site for the perfect set of footprints that would fit nicely behind the museum's famous Brontosaurus Mount. What we found instead was some quite intriguing dinosaur swim tracks. The tracks made us think of small to medium-sized theropods, similar to Meganosaurus and Dilophosaurus. The large number of smaller-sized swim tracks hinted that whatever dinosaurs made those tracks were moving as a group as they struggled against the current in the lake shallows. The larger dinosaurs, on the other hand, were a bit taller and able to wade where their smaller cousins splashed around. These dinosaurs' footprints were in fact claw marks, which suggest that the theropods were swimming near the surface of a river and just the tips of their toes and claws could touch the bottom. The tracks indicated a coordinated left-right progression, which supports the proposition that the theropods were well-coordinated swimmers. And what's more, the tracks implied that the theropods that made them were swimming against a current that pushed them diagonally.
But Martin, is this enough to prove beyond doubt that dinosaurs like Dilophosaurus were adapted to an amphibious lifestyle?
Absolutely not. The truth is that the swimming strokes of these dinosaurs were exaggerated walking motions. The way the dinosaurs moved on land allowed them to be adequate swimmers while crossing rivers or lakes, but compared with semi-aquatic animals such as crocodiles and otters, no known dinosaur shows traits indicative of a primarily water-based existence. Some dinosaurs could swim, but that doesn't mean that they made the water their home. Still, thanks to special prehistoric traces, we can imagine packs of Meganosaurus fighting to get ashore, and Dilophosaurus strutting into the shallows, aiming to snatch whatever fish were foolish enough to swim into the carnivore's shadow.
Now you will hear the segment again.
None of us were around when the dinosaurs became extinct, but this doesn't stop us from being fascinated by these awesome animals, and it certainly does not stop scientists from continuing to investigate them. New evidence suggests that carnivorous theropod dinosaurs, who were once thought to be hydrophobic, at least sometimes took a dip in lakes and rivers. Kimberly Morgan reports.
Paleontologists have recently uncovered good evidence that theropod dinosaurs, whose name derives from a Greek phrase meaning beast feet, describing the dinosaurs' oversized appendages, weren't as bothered by water as traditionally believed. In 2013, paleontologists Andrew Mitchell and Martin Perez described swim tracks made by early Jurassic theropods at the site where now stands the city of St. George, Utah. Such traces weren't the first of their kind ever discovered, but the track site was one of the richest ever found. Andrew and Martin are here with us today to give us the fascinating details. Andrew, we're all ears.
Kimberly, we were hired by the American Museum of Natural History and were combing the site for the perfect set of footprints that would fit nicely behind the museum's famous Brontosaurus Mount. What we found instead was some quite intriguing dinosaur swim tracks. The tracks made us think of small to medium-sized theropods, similar to Meganosaurus and Dilophosaurus. The large number of smaller-sized swim tracks hinted that whatever dinosaurs made those tracks were moving as a group as they struggled against the current in the lake shallows. The larger dinosaurs, on the other hand, were a bit taller and able to wade where their smaller cousins splashed around. These dinosaurs' footprints were in fact claw marks, which suggest that the theropods were swimming near the surface of a river and just the tips of their toes and claws could touch the bottom. The tracks indicated a coordinated left-right progression, which supports the proposition that the theropods were well-coordinated swimmers. And what's more, the tracks implied that the theropods that made them were swimming against a current that pushed them diagonally.
But Martin, is this enough to prove beyond doubt that dinosaurs like Dilophosaurus were adapted to an amphibious lifestyle?
Absolutely not. The truth is that the swimming strokes of these dinosaurs were exaggerated walking motions. The way that dinosaurs moved on land allowed them to be adequate swimmers while crossing rivers or lakes, but compared with semi-aquatic animals such as crocodiles and otters, no known dinosaur shows traits indicative of a primarily water-based existence. Some dinosaurs could swim, but that doesn't mean that they made the water their home. Still, thanks to special prehistoric traces, we can imagine packs of Meganosaurus fighting to get ashore, and Dilophosaurus strutting into the shallows, aiming to snatch whatever fish were foolish enough to swim into the carnivore's shadow.
Number 45. What is the purpose of the report? Number 46. What is true of the theropods? Number 47. What was special about the swim tracks? Number 48. How did the paleontologists find the swim tracks? Number 49. What did the tracks suggest about the theropods? Number 50. What can be concluded about the theropods compared with crocodiles and otters? End of the listening test.